This podcast is brought to you by A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. By the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan, come together to worship and serve. And by Molly Maid. Make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today.
Sumaya Matan is a writer, part-time social worker slash psychotherapist, and strategic advisor for the Ontario government, working on a wide range of public policy files, including anti-racism. Her book, The Shaitan Bride, is a true coming-of-age story of a girl navigating desire and faith. Through her journey into adulthood, she battles herself and her circumstances to differentiate between destiny and free will. Sumaya Matan's life in love and violence is a testament to one woman's strength as she faces the complicated fallout of her decisions. We talk about her book and so much more on The Vicar's Crossing.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever and wherever you may be listening. We welcome you back to another edition of the Vicar's Crossing podcast, a virtual space Yay! Where faith intersects with the public square, and where Kevin and Ian and I have intersected with you today, and we're happy about that.
Thanks good for see being Ian here. Again. Good to see you.
Yeah,
again,
good Robin. To see yeah. you back on the screen, yeah. handsome young guy. I'm Rob Henderson from Holy Trinity St. Stephen's in London,
and I'm Kevin George from St. Aidan's Church, Northwest London,
and I'm Ian. Guy. And as they've told the very handsome one at the bottom of the screen here, who edits his podcast and sends it out into the world.
He's one of them. Remember my cousin Vinny? He's one of those yeah. Utes. He's one of those
He's
Utes.
A Ute.
He's a Ute. These two and, Utes.
And unlike Kevin and I, who have a face for radio.
Yeah.
Ian's doing much better.
Ian's handsome. What a handsome lad.
Well, I recently got new glasses, so I'm sure that's
well,
all.
Well,
you
look it.
Good. Yeah, that's it.
I personally find myself man crushing when you look crazy. I secretly want to be you, Ian. I'm like, if I could just be Ian, I'd be a happy guy.
Season eight, fourth episode of season eight of The Vicar's Crossing. And today we have a new guest. Excited to welcome to the podcast. Sumaya Matan, and Sumaya is a writer and part-time social worker and psychotherapist, as well as a strategic advisor of the Ontario government, who has worked on a wide range of public policy files, including anti-racism. And as an author and writer, she has a book which is titled The Shaitan Bride, a Bangladeshi-Canadian memoir of desire and faith, which was released in 2021. And it's a coming-of-age story of a girl navigating desire and faith and her life in love and violence, quite a testament to one woman's strength as she faces the complicated fallout of her decisions. And a wonderful story, and we're going to get into that with Sumaya coming up in just a few minutes.
It's such a great book. And the one thing I want to note about this, you know, before we get to it as well, is just the nature of which, and she starts the book with this disclaimer that says this is not a rescue story, because it's a story of her. She went to visit family as a 19-year-old in Bangladesh, and she's more or less held hostage and being forced into a marriage, not an arranged marriage, a forced marriage. Mm-hmm. And she was hesitant to write this book because of implicit biases that we all bring to the reading. Sure. Of anything and our thoughts about arranged marriage here in the West, et cetera, et cetera. And she really invites us to park that at the door and hear her story as something right. fresh, which right. it really is, because her faith is something that means so much to her. And she didn't want this to in any way feed into, you know, sort of negative stereotypes and implicit biases and Islamophobia. But anyway, more on that later. We want to get into all that, but we want to acknowledge that the place from which we originate this podcast are the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, Lenape, and Attawandaran peoples, and are connected with the London Township and Somber Treaties of 1796. And these lands continue to be home to diverse Indigenous peoples whom we recognize as contemporary stewards of the land and as vital contributors of our society, and people with whom we wish to walk the path towards reconciliation.
And we also want to take a moment to thank our sponsors here on the Vicar's Crossing podcast, great supporters of what we're doing here. First to A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. And our thanks to Dave Mullen, and a big shout-out to everybody at A. Miller George today. Thanks so much for being a part of it.
Yep, and a great thanks to the Diocese of Huron, Todd Townsend, Bishop down there. They've been very good to us. It's a community of families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, from Grand Bend to Port Rowan, and all points in between. People are coming together on Sunday singing, "All Creatures of Our God and King."
And last but certainly not least, you just want to say a big thank you to Molly Maid. Make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. They'll come in and clean your floors, all of that good stuff.
Clean, yeah. All right. Good
Heck
stuff.
Yeah.
Well, Samaya's here. She's been waiting as we've been yakking on. Yep. So we're going to bring her in from Toronto, just down the road, and talk to her and get into the book and much, much more on the Vicar's Crossing podcast.
All right.
And Samaya joining us now in the Vicar's Crossing podcast. Samaya, we're so happy to have you aboard with us. So happy to be able to chat a bit more with you and about your book and so much more. How are things in Toronto today? I'm sure you're getting maybe a little bit of the snow we're getting.
Very snowy. I just got back from Bangladesh, actually. So okay.
Where I bet it's not snowing.
Yeah, exactly. So totally different from hot mosquito weather to snow.
Well, I'm glad you made it back safe and sound. Yeah, we never know anymore getting back into the with all the weather we've been having. So glad you're aboard.
So happy you can join us, Samaya. I can only imagine how's the jet lag? Are you getting over that?
Yes, I mean, last couple of nights I did not get any sleep at all. Random hours, but getting better. Yeah.
How far ahead is Bangladesh?
I think,
how many hours?
I think it's about 8 hours, but don't quote. Yeah.
Ahead. That's not good. Look, congratulations on the book. A couple of years old now, I guess. But I really love reading it. I actually read it in two sittings. I just could not put this memoir down. Your story is so compelling, and you're such a strong woman, what you've been through and how you've carried that, and particularly how you've carried it and still honored your faith and what that means to you and how you've kept that together. This book really pulls the reader in and demands that those of us who are reading it, he or she, really pay attention to the complexities of relationships, of culture, of faith, and of how all of these, for better or for worse, impact who we are and they impact who we are becoming. I've heard you express in other interviews talking about your memoir that you had some hesitancy about telling this story. And largely tied to really not wanting to feed Islamophobia or negative stereotypes that people have of Islam. In fact, in the very first page of your book, it's two lines and it's a disclaimer. And it says this, disclaimer, this is not a rescue story. Talk to us about the importance of that disclaimer. I mean, for those of you who are hearing about this book for the first time, you'll come to know more throughout this interview, but it really is a story of Samaya having to make her way back home to Canada from her original home in Bangladesh. But talk to us about the importance of that disclaimer that this is not a rescue story and the internal complexities that you had to come to grips with in order to write such an honest and vulnerable retelling of your journey with God to this point in your life.
For sure. Before I start, I don't think we mentioned the title of the book.
But we did before we brought you on. But
Okay. I'll just
right here. Tell us all. It's the Shaitan Bride, yeah?
Yes.
Shaitan Bride.
Yes. The Shaitan Bride. Yes. And also, I just wanted to say thank you for having me. And it's an honor to be here to have this discussion. So I really appreciate it.
Oh, but yeah, awesome.
to go on answering your question, so I guess I'll start with just saying that, you know, when I started writing this memoir, I was quite aware that in the Canadian literary landscape, there aren't that many racialized Muslim writers that get published. And so we still have, the publishing industry still has a lot of work to do when it comes to representation of voices. And so I think the effect that that has is that the few authors that do get published, there's this incredible onus that gets placed on them, or that they take on, where their voice sort of becomes this representation of their entire community or their community's experiences and histories. And so I was quite aware of that onus. Mm-hmm. I felt it very strongly. And I also knew that, you know, the types of stories that do get published, I noticed that there were patterns in terms of how those stories were framed. You know, I'd done a little bit of a scan on different memoirs that dealt with topics of forced marriage that involved Muslim women, or journal articles that talked about similar topics. And I found that there was a bit of a trend when it came to the way that the headlines and, you know, the content was framed. It usually was something along the lines of, you know, escaping an oppressive culture or religion or family. And that those titles that framing didn't sit well with me. And I felt that they were quite colonial in nature, in that I felt that they echoed sort of this long history that we've had all over the world throughout time, where, you know, certain narratives became the dominant narrative, and that reinforced particular ideas about inferiority and superiority. And so I was quite mindful of that going into writing this memoir. And in addition to that, I was working on it during COVID. And I'll go back and think about how it was like during the COVID. Time, you know, there was so much fear, there was so much anti-Asian hate, but also we really got to see some of the stratification of society according to, like, the privileges that people had, and, like, access to resources, and there was so much of that. And I thought a lot about sort of the vulnerabilities that certain communities experienced in that context, you know, especially, like, thinking about Muslim women who were in situations of domestic violence or potential domestic violence, who didn't have access to their usual coping mechanisms, for example. And so thinking a lot about that, I would say fear and anxiety, like, was at the forefront of my mind.
I bet.
How the book would be received, but also personally as well, thinking a lot about my family. And then going back to just in general, you know, thinking about, like, during high stress times, how oftentimes we revert to, like, rhetoric that reinforces, like, fear. And so just really mindful of that. So it wasn't fun, like, thinking about I think what really struck me, though, after kind of being in paralysis for, like, a couple of weeks and facing a lot of writer's block and thinking about these things, was that this thought that crossed my mind, I won't quote, like, the particular hadith, because I don't know, like, I can't remember
fair enough,
where it's from exactly, but it's something along the lines of, you know, express the truth even if the truth is bitter, or if you're gonna say a word, at least say the truth, something along the lines of that. And I kind of sat with that for a bit, and I thought that, you know, the most important thing I could do is just write a story that is as honest as possible. Of course, personal truth is subjective, and that everybody has their own truth. You know, I was in a position to like express that truth, my truth, and I had a right to do that. And so just really kind of grounding myself and giving myself permission to do that. And also thinking a lot about the benefits of writing a story like that, where other members of the community could potentially feel seen. Whereas as a lot of these topics aren't necessarily, discussed publicly, or even like within families as well. So I kind of just gave myself permission to do that, despite the fear. And I think, just to add to that, in terms of my story and writing my truth, I really boiled it down to the crux of the story, which was essentially an internal conflict that I experienced that led to my relationship with God. Because if I think about it deeply, you know, it's very much about like wanting love from God and wanting to be loved by God, to love, not, and sort of worrying about losing that connection, and whether that love in this book, you know, is communicated also through by, you know, talking about my family as an extension or the romantic interest or the culture or whatnot. Like it's all an extension of this very core drive, which was to feel connected and to feel love and not wanting that to be taken away. And so I think once I sort of focused in on that a little bit, that allowed me to just like write whatever came to me. Of course, I think at some points in the writing, like there was fear that came up and I just acknowledged that fear. And you might have noticed in the memoir, yeah, I talk about the fear. And I think that's all I could do was really just name it in the process as it came up.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. You can read in the book that you articulate well the complexities in the sense of being able to talk about your own faith and how that even supported you in your most traumatic moments and you know, beyond. Help our listeners now understand the title of the book. Who is the Shaitan in Islam? And elaborate on the concept of the Shaitan bride and how you use it really as a bit of a literary device throughout this memoir.
Yeah, for sure. So the Shaitan is, I would say, equivalent to Satan in Christianity or popular culture. And the reason that Shaitan is a part of the story, such a central part of the story, it kind of goes back to the stories that I heard as a young girl that I mentioned in the memoir, where, you know, women who deviated from what was expected of them or were troublemakers or, you know, did something other than what they were told, they were often referred to as, you know, having done shaitani or being devilish, or like the language that was often used to talk about women or young girls in these contexts seemed to always revolve around shaitan. And so I kind of sat with that like from an early age and wondered about that. And as I grew older, there was just a lot more thoughts that I had around the relationship between morality, like being good and bad, and sexuality and gender. And it just seemed that there was a lot of, it was quite loaded when it came to that, when it came to women and faith, religion, gender, sexuality, especially as it pertained to women. And so, and I found that like in other stories of, you know, jinns who are like basically creatures made of smokeless fire that could be ill-intentioned or like positive, just, you know, as sort of tools of shaitan to get humans to do like ill. I found that stories of jinn that involved men, they're often quite like transformative. Like it sounded as if, you know, they had gone through some sort of spiritual experience and gotten closer to God. So a perfect example of that is, you know, the story of Layla and Majnu. I think the story comes from like Arabic, Indian, like that part of the world. And, there's many different explanations or versions of it. But one of the versions is that, you know, there's this like man who falls in love with this woman. So Majnu falls in love with Layla, but then, you know, cannot seem to find Layla after like she kind of goes missing. And then he spends like so long trying to find her. I think the context is that her family doesn't approve of her being with him. And then she's forced to get married to someone else or something like that in one of the iterations. And so he goes on just like yearning for her love for so many years, and eventually comes to realize that this void that he has is actually him seeking a deeper connection with the divine. And she's sort of a catalyst, in whether it be in the form of a djinn or an actual person, it's sort of a portal or a gateway for him to connect. However, I have never read any stories about women who had gone through it, these kinds of transformations. The stories that I heard about women and djinn, ill-intentioned djinns or shaitan, usually just resulted in them, you know, sort of being overtaken, being powerless, being weak, and having to kind of like protect themselves from the shaitan, being more vulnerable. And so that was really interesting. And through that story, as a literary device, I wanted to, you know, kind of subvert that narrative. And, you know, being called a shaitan or being called immoral, for young women who, you know, find themselves in situations like I did, when I was young, like it can be quite, it can have a lot of mental health impacts for them.
It's gotta be crushing. Yeah. In our parlance, it's the bride of Satan.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And like, it could be used as a form of spiritual abuse. Like I'll just throw in that word because you know, kind of like using concepts that, so what I wanted to do was like really tell a story about words that had been used on me, directed toward me, or that I had heard, and kind of subvert that narrative. The other part of this is that if we look back at Shaitan's history, Shaitan was actually originally Iblis. So Iblis was like in the memoir, I describe Iblis as being really like misunderstood. So this is a Sufi interpretation of Iblis. Yeah. So Iblis, before Iblis became Shaitan, refused to bow down to Adam because the story is that Iblis felt that, you know, Adam could not be equated with God, and therefore Iblis did not want to bow down to anything other than God. And so in that, Sufi philosophy is described as the ultimate monotheist and like the most devoted to God. But in that situation, Iblis is cast out and, you know, out of paradise, and then Iblis then becomes Shaitan and then has this goal and mission to lure humans into doing ill. And so we're listening to like the parts of themselves that draw them doing ill. And so this misunderstanding of Iblis, like the original, that beginning story, I bring Iblis up in my book because, you know, I describe in the book how a lot of my adolescence was misunderstood. And I think that misunderstanding also applies to just like understanding religion in general, and just like forced marriage as a topic, or just like experiences. So just like overall, it was just a common theme. And so I thought Iblis was such a great character to kind of frame the story around, because it's, you know, you have this tragic romantic hero that is driven to, you know, serve and love, and but then is like shockingly sort of misunderstood, and there's so many consequences that Iblis experiences. And then the turning point is where Iblis, like the pain and the it kind of solidifies inside, and he becomes Shaitan. And so it's like this play on, you know, what happens when we experience these kinds of shocking events as well. And how do we reconcile, traumatic experiences, or experiences where, you know, there's things don't make sense anymore in terms of light and darkness. And, if I think back to that time when I was in Bangladesh for 5 months and seeing my family members, whom I loved so much, kind of being like, basically, not listen to what I had to honor that. And it was shocking. And it didn't make sense to me. It didn't make sense, like, how there was a loss of innocence there, I think, as well, in terms of how I viewed the world or understand the world and the complexities of human beings, which I didn't know about at that time.
So, well, you were young. You were 19. Yeah. I think, you know, Rob's got a question here before he does. Just that I think the thing that comes out of that for me is in terms of how you use the shaitan as a literary device is you really do a good job of, the complexity of, if we just use the terms good and evil, Alexander Stoltzkin said that the line between good and evil runs through the heart of every man, that it's not as simple as being able to identify the darkness or bad things or whatever as something that's out there, that it's within us at times. And so the way you talk about it, it's almost seductive or haunting or, I'm never afraid. Reading the memoir, I was never afraid when you wrote about Shaitan. It wasn't like a fear of it. It was like this sort of familiarity. And so your willingness to enter into that, I think, was really, really profound and helpful as a reader of the text itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we want to get into a little bit of your story, too. And it's an incredible story. And we'll start with, coming to Canada and some of the stories around that, immigrating with your family when you were just 6 years old and you end up landing in Thunder Bay, and it's cold. It's always cold. Yeah. In Thunder Bay. What a contrast, right? From where you came from and culture and everything else. And you describe in the book, the difficulties that you felt, at such a young age and, fitting in is not going to be easy. Cultural differences and racism, just the newness of all of that. And you're right about your father, an engineer by training, expressing his frustration with trying to find employment, right? And you're right that your dad was especially fond of reminiscing after long days of job hunting that seemed to kind of impose his mood upon the house, the gravitas, even the speed at which shadows moved across the room, as you write so beautifully here. When he returned to the dinner table, he'd share his distaste with the interviewing process that he was going through. And he would say, I have experience and I'm fluent in English. They just keep asking for Canadian experience. What does that really mean? And then as the years passed, the disappointment in his eyes melted into a steadfast river of responsibility. Mm. And it was there in this new home, this new beginning that you described, first getting a sense of a visit from the Shaitan bride. Can you say more about maybe those first months in Thunder Bay before you actually moved to Toronto and give us more of a context of that for you?
Yeah, for sure. So I remember that time period through fragments of memories. I was still young, so not quite clear. So even when I was writing, it was just a series of vignettes that sort of popped up in my mind that I used to and put together the narrative. From what I do remember, it was such an exciting time, but it was also a time of newness and change and, some stress and tension, a mix of so many emotions. And one of the most important changes that, like, vivid changes, memories that I can remember is, like, just the space, the difference in space. Like, Taka had such a population density issue.
In Thunder Bay, holy smokes.
Like, just walking down the street and you're always in Taka, you're always like, there's the personal space you have is very little. Wake up to the sights, like the sounds and sights that are, like, constantly ongoing, the rickshaw bells, the man outside selling vegetables or what. It becomes such a normal part of your experience. And so in Thunder Bay, it was completely quiet. The spaces between houses were large.
Must have felt huge.
Yeah. And that was exciting for me because it was almost like, this space to explore. And I felt like a very unique connection with nature. And it might be quite cliche to talk about Canadian wilderness. And I know
loons.
Yeah. But it's literally, I felt very connected to it. And I think, that part of that experience really resonated with me. At the same time, there was differences in my experience when it came to people. You know, like for the first time when I turned on the television, I was seeing people that looked completely different. I remember scenes like in my head of like my immediate family and my relatives sitting in the basement watching Hollywood movies, and there would be these scenes, like sex scenes, and we'd all like cover our eyes. Like laugh, which is something that never happened in Bangladesh. Like we wouldn't really see that. Like on
interesting. How very interesting.
Right? Yeah. Like little things like that were different. And then in school, you know, just being very quiet and just observing people speak English. I went to an English medium school in Dhaka, but in Thunder Bay, you know, I felt particularly like I don't know what it was. Like, I can't quite remember. But I just felt like it was different. And I just needed time to absorb my surroundings. And I described in my book at some point, you know, I just can't, I just start talking and then I don't stop. So all of that was like very, very new. I did want to note that, you know, one of the experiences, and I think this is very common and when you migrate, is like the sense of being embedded in a social fabric. That is something at the time I might not have had words to articulate, but looking back and even now to this day, I feel that this is a very big, like it's something to grieve. In Bangladesh and Dhaka, you know, when you walk down the street, everybody knows whose daughter you are, they know your grandfather, your grandfather's father. There's like this lineage, there's this like family history. And you feel it in a fabric. Whereas, like, of course, when you migrate to a new place, you're sort of creating that for yourself from scratch. That's one, like, really big loss, even up till today, that I often feel. It almost feels like I'm sort of floating around sometimes here. And, you know, kind of not planting my feet completely into the soil. And there's some theories that talk about that. There's this one theory that, and I can't quite remember who the psychologist is, but there's this concept of the home country or motherland being a mother and the migrant sort of being like weaned out of that experience of, you know, that infancy and being close to the motherland, being sort of thrown out into the world. And there's always this longing or yearning for the warmth of a motherland or a place. And of course, that place is constantly changing. It doesn't stay the same, but it's almost like there's this like sense or this memory that you kind of take with you. Doesn't matter where it is you're traveling to. And so I would describe that meaning to be like, I would say that resonates with me, just go living and going to different places, but then carrying sort of pieces of all those places with me, but particularly the place where I spent my infancy and my young years. So I think that sense was always there. And I think I wanted to also mention, and this is really interesting, and it's with respect to the Shaitan Bride. And, you know, I used it, that mention of the Shaitan Bride in that particular chapter at the end, because it sort of foreshadows what's to come the chapters after. And it also signifies to me how, you know, the I don't want to say baggage is not the right word, but almost like the experience of like gender and gendered expectations, like it traverses geographical boundaries. Right. Like even though I was now in Canada, some of, you know, what the stories that I had heard in Bangladesh about these women, they would be carried with me to this place. But not only that, I would also experience those kinds of stories, but in a different form in this space. So there was that. But the other element that I would say that signified for me was just the idea of like supernatural and spiritual experiences. I think sometimes when we think about the East or countries what, you know, there's this sort of like, it's really interesting. Even when I go back to Bangladesh now, you're having conversations about jinns or, like faith, like those kinds of conversations are much easier to have in those contexts.
I bet.
It's almost like when you come to the West, it becomes compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. It's like there isn't much room for that. But I think that that's a part of human experience.
Yeah.
And so for me, having the Shaitan Bride appear in that chapter signifies that there's still that part of me that exists, and that type of experience still exists, even though we are now in this like Western land where that's not part of the common universe, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. So then to continue on your journey, you don't stay in Thunder Bay because you end up in Toronto.
Because she's got better sense.
That's right.
Thunder Bay, send your letters to Rob Henderson.
Yeah,
Rob Henderson.
Love Thunder Bay. But anyway, you end up in Toronto in a neighborhood nicknamed The Jungle. It's an area of Lawrence Heights in North York. And you describe it as a cluster of, you know, low-rise public housing apartments. And you talk about living in the interior units of these apartment complexes as kind of being in the belly of the beast. And you go on to describe it as a biome of as people from all over the world living together in twined ways. And its name, you know, is racist and was a place that was misunderstood by outsiders. And a few years after moving there, your dad has a horrible thing happen. He has a brain bleed, and it was a near-death experience for him. And you write about him coming out of that and then taking his duty as a father to protect his children all the more seriously. And you talk about how he was more, you know, conscious of your online life, you know, what you were wearing and who you're hanging out with, et cetera, even going so far as to ask you to be mindful of the news around you. And these were the days around 9/11. And what you later realized was your father was wanting to for you to think critically about your Muslim identity and what that meant in this place that you were now living. And you say you felt this as restriction, but that just years later, you would see the ways in which the survival of Muslim men and their families have had such a devastating effect. Can you say more about that surveillance period or that surveillance placed on you by your father, that pressure in your family and ultimately on you as you kind of, you know, felt your own freedom to be wanting to be like other adolescents that was hindered a bit? What was that experience for you?
Yeah, for sure. What's really interesting, I find, and this is in retrospect, is that a lot of what was happening throughout the trajectory of time was mirroring my coming of age. So, you know, when I was in the early years coming from Dhaka to Thunder Bay, like entering into Canada, like what we were just talking about, you know, that time period was very much about just like the sense of newness, but also displacement and kind of trying to understand like supernatural, spiritual, kind of where the boundaries are with that, like entering into this Canadian, like Western space, like, but like developmentally, it's like at that age, in terms of how you're processing things, you know, you're kind of like what's the word? Like thinking about fantasy and, you know, magic. Like it's almost like the way I've written it, and I've realized this after, it's like it mirrors the developmental experience of a young girl. And so this period in Jungle was preteen, puberty, teenage years. And this is, as you mentioned, the time where 9/11 was happening, and the rhetoric around Muslim men as being dangerous and women as being oppressed, and the backwardness in Muslim communities, that was very, very much heightened. And not just like in terms of, you know, the rhetoric, but also like actual policy and practices that was happening at a very systemic level, you know, like racial profiling, airport stops, like interrogation.
Mm. Yeah.
you know, surveilling like online activity. There was like so much that was happening systemically, but also, you know, just in a day-to-day experience of a Muslim person walking the streets, especially if you were visibly Muslim. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the gendered Islamophobia as well, where, you know, if you're wearing hijab or other, like other forms of identification that you belong to the community. And so that was the climate. And I feel like at that time, because of the climate, there was this sort of, the conversation about faith became very much black and white. It became very much, very dichotomous. Like it was East versus West, you know, modern versus backward. It was like, you're with us or you're not, or like, where, which camp are you on? And so that dichotomy, it was quite difficult for me to kind of process that at the age that I was in. And if you think about the adolescent brain, at that time, you know, that's the time where you're developmentally and biologically, you're sort of developing complex thoughts. Like the world is no longer simplified with black and white. You're kind of processing things emotionally, intellectually, like you're sort of, the complexity increases. And so I think the rhetoric wasn't sitting well with me because it didn't make sense to me. When you know, I think it's very natural though, when you do hear this kind of rhetoric and you have these experiences, for fear and anxiety to be heightened, there's like a certain visibility that you feel in public spaces. Yeah. And a lot of Muslim communities felt that way, like just walking, like just thinking about some of the hate crimes that occurred walking down the streets. If you're visibly Muslim, the violence, the impact of the violence experienced by someone who'd, let's say, been attacked, you know, like those we experience collectively, even if it didn't yeah. happen to us as individual Muslims, seeing that in the media or hearing about it has devastating impacts. And yeah. so kind of in this fear state and shaken to the core. And, you know, at that point, in terms of my relationship with my dad, you know, I just want to say that, like, he's a very intellectual person in that, like, when he has discussions, he's very much about, like, thinking through things. Like, it's not your stereotypical sort of, you know, Muslim man laying down the rules, but rather he encourages a lot of reflection and discussion, has mm-hmm. a lot of empathy. So mm-hmm. I think it's just at that point, because of the heightened sort of you're on this camp or that camp, as an adolescent, registering any discussion about faith felt very much like, you know, a choice that I had to make. Mm-hmm. About who I wanted to be. And when you're in a state of fear and anxiety, I think, like with my dad, he very much encouraged us to go back and think about our roots and, you know, reflect on what it meant to be Muslim. And, you know, he aspired for us to present ourselves yeah. in a cool way, connect more to our roots. And I think it's a natural response too. Like when you feel like you're not being seen or understood in the broader community, you want to feel empowered in some kind of way. And so that would be the source of the empowerment. But it clashed very much with where I was in my developmental needs and the context that I was in. Because as a teenager, you know, you like your main priority is to somehow fit in with mm-hmm. people that you're around, or to establish your own unique identity. But in order to do that, you kind of have to put yourself into different social groups. You need to explore yourself. And so it was like a very much like a clash in terms of, you know, the needs I had as a teenager, as an adolescent, growing, developing, wanting to explore myself, wanting to, you know, like connect with my peers, be more like my peers, but at the same time being like strangely visible, but in a very negative way because of what I was seeing in the media. And then in terms of trying to find empowerment in my faith or my culture, not feeling connected at the time to the way that was being asked of me from my dad or from like my family environment, because to me that felt quite like it didn't quite, I didn't, as I say in the book, you know, because I was in a, I didn't have that much representation around me in terms of like, you know, other Muslim, like I didn't even have hardly had Muslim friends. There was only like two South Asians in my school. So it was a like tricky time. And so this is what I think it's really important to think about diversity in all contexts, because it really does make such a difference in terms of how much a person feels like they belong and can express all the different parts of themselves and can have such a positive impact on mental health. Because I know during those years, as I say in my memoir, like I had lots of mental health struggles at that time. So yeah, so I would say it was just, it was a very unique sort of interaction between all of these forces at that time. I also describe in the memoir that it's not just like this vigilance from the, you know, other communities who are not Muslim, sort of looking at Muslim communities, but also within Muslim communities as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Like Muslims looking at other Muslims, like how Muslim are you? Like, are you sending, you know, like, what are you doing or not doing? Like, and so that itself also was quite constraining for me because, of course, I needed to find the religion and faith in my own way. I needed to make sense of it and express it in my own way. I needed to like learn about it through exposure to different ways of talking about it and different mentors. And so it, like all of those kinds of needs, they were very much constrained because of the pressures of that time societally trickling down and at the community level. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the way when I read it was sort of like trickle down surveillance. That's what I called it, because it's this idea of like, you know, your father feels that pressure, your mother feels that pressure. And I couldn't help but think of the Afzal family here in London who were walking down the street here, like 3 kilometers from where I sit right now, when 3 generations of that family were wiped out and left young Fayez to be on his own. And they were targeted because they wore traditional clothing from back home in India. They were a Muslim family. And, you know, you realize that, and, you know, the march that ensued out of that was a lot of folks in this city saying, you know, we're learning for some of us for the first time, just what it's like to be living under that sort of surveillance and criticism and the need for us to hear more diverse voices at all levels. So, I mean, I really was taken by so much of what you wrote there. You also write about falling in love with Bav. Am I saying that right, Bav?
Yeah, Bav.
Bav. And is Bav Bav's name?
Or no.
Like, no, okay. Yeah, I wondered. I was like, I wonder, is she writing about Bav? And Bav is like, Bav is sitting back reading this going, oh my gosh. So Bav gets an anonymous name, right?
Yeah. All of them.
Okay, good. So Bav was Sikh, is Sikh, remains Sikh probably, but in the book, I mean, you know, I was reading about him. You write about forbidden moments and not being able to talk about them and feeling that it wasn't something that you were able to discuss. And again, you get that nuance of the shaitan, you know, like in the midst of this. You write about being many people in one body is the way you describe it, which I thought was really quite fascinating. You describe the discomfiture that ate away at your peace. In your love with Bav, you would move from pleasure to shame. And you write about that by saying, I was playing with fire in a slow burning hell, yet it brought me closer to my faith in ways I had never been before. I became more aware of my nafs, and this led me to ask questions. Did sinning mean you didn't belong within particular lines of religions or communities, that you shouldn't simply leave? Or did it mean the sins you faced were your test? Did good things come more easily to those who obeyed or those who failed and then tried again? For God would never give a person a burden that was more than they could bear. What made a good person? A good woman. Within the dark light, I looked for clarity. All of this you write, in all of this you write, one thing was clear. What women do with their bodies and what feelings they have cannot be imposed on them. Can they be taken, imposed on them, nor can they be taken. Not through a look, nor rationale, scientific explanation. Nothing that is done to can tamper with. As a human, her dignity is an innate right, and what she does with her body is for her to define. I thought, wow, that is a powerful, both, it's a powerful faith statement, it's a powerful feminist statement, it's a powerful statement about dignity for women. It's such an incredibly and critically important point you make at that point in the book. Can you say more about what you were experiencing in those years as a young woman coming out of adolescence, a young woman coming of age, and how the pressures that you were under affected your faith, or perhaps how your faith helped you navigate that process? Because one of the things that I found most special about this is that you don't describe your faith as a challenge to this as much as you do something that got you through it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, those were really hard years.
I bet. Like
really hard years. Yeah, so I think what I struggled with the most with that relationship, and I'll say this actually before I start with getting into that, that I was quite young at the time. Like I'd met Bob. Was 15 and 21. And so, you know, that's something, it's interesting because like in retrospect and now as I'm talking about that relationship, some people are like, I've had feedback where they sort of questioned that age gap and, you know, like sort of why Bob would pursue someone who was so young and like how quickly I kind of fell into this situation at such a young age and you know, at a time where young girls are exploring their identity or being with friends or pursuing hobbies. And so that's something that I thought about quite a bit as I was writing, but especially after I wrote the book and reflecting on it. And I just wanted to make a note that I think some of that, like the normalization of that had a lot to do with culture as well. Yeah. Very much common in my culture, as you could tell from the book, that for relationships to happen between, you know, older males and younger
females.
But anyhow, that's just a little something that I've been sitting with and processing and what that means. But anyhow, I would still stand by the fact that I did experience that relationship as love. And I think what I struggled with the most about that, there was one, because it was premarital. It was a relationship outside of marriage. And my faith was, it was quite important to me at that time. That was a message I had received from an early age, you know, not engaging in any kind of relationships, especially, you know, physical, sexual relationships outside of marriage. So that was a very strong message. So that the premarital nature of that relationship, but also just the inability to like talk about it. And so the secrecy around it was something I very much struggled with because I felt it clashed against like my sense of being a good person at the time. And then also, and like not being honest, like enough, like with my parents, but rightfully so, because I was scared. In addition to that, what I grappled with about that was just also messages around interfaith relationships. And that was, it's such a huge topic that, you know, even now, like to this day, that many Muslim women are trying to navigate and understand. And at that time, at such a young age, like it was very hard for me to process all of that. And so, you know, one thing that's really interesting about that whole thing is that, you know, as I say in the memoir, there's, in terms of who people can marry, you know, they, and this, of course, I'm talking about just like the heterosexual.
Yes.
Right now. Within that, you know, Muslim men allowed to marry people of the book. So like Christian, Jewish, like monotheistic religion, whereas Muslim women, you know, commonly people like they say, you know, they just cannot marry outside of the faith. That's sort of like something that's sort of taken with as normal. And so, but I never really understood why. And so when I, at that age, when I tried to kind of dig into that, you know, there was these, it was never really clear because, you know, there's all these like passages that were quoted, but none of them directly really stated much that made complete sense to me. Like it wasn't really working with my logic. And then outside of the Quranic passages and texts, you know, there was also like these cultural reasons. So for example, these messages I had received about, you know, well, men usually would be the head of the household. So if a Muslim woman marries someone who's non-Muslim, she's more likely to be under his influence and then therefore lose her faith. Or if they have children, the child will probably take the father's identity and not the mother's, even though the mother spends so much time potentially with the child. So these kind of, you know, assumptions, they were sort of the grounding reasons for why Muslim marriages between Muslim women and non-Muslim men were discouraged. But they sat on an existing framework of patriarchy, of like, you know, it of assumptions about like power, really, like male privilege, really, like the authority that would come with like a specific gender. And so that was troubling for me because I just didn't feel like that was necessarily a complete reflection of reality. Like, you know, I grappled with that. And I also felt like that seemed human constructed to me. It didn't seem like a divine message. It didn't have that kind of a quality that felt divine to me. But the thing about that is that it was complicated because the thing with Islam is that there's a lot of like deep philosophy behind it, but there's a component of the religion that's very much based on social connections and social order community. And so like one cannot be separated out of the community. It's quite collectivist. And so I think like on a very like practical level, if we were to kind of think about the scholars back in the days, you know, looking at the social conditions of that time and, you know, looking at Sharia law and then, you know, creating these guidelines for how to navigate different aspects of society and like living. You know, it like the part of Islam that tries to make the religion not just a spiritual sort of experience, but rather something that can be practically applied so that people can actually express virtue in very concrete ways in the communities that they live in and that they serve. Like it's understandable how some of these these rules or these like guidelines might've been created at a particular point in history. And of course, like, I'm not going to get into that because I'm not an expert. There's so much nuance and so much complexities related to that. But essentially what wasn't working for me was I felt like the interpretations of that were very much based on like a reality that may be changing in the present moment and in the context that I was in. And so the question was like, you know, in order to be a Muslim, like, you know, spiritually, I felt quite connected to some of the really deep messages that were very egalitarian, actually. You know, we talk about the souls, all souls being equal. You know, we talk about this concept of fitra and like also how all souls are you know, we assume are born good, with goodness. And so there's this sort of, and also, you know, when you go like Day of Judgment and you're in front of Allah, everybody is on the same sort of, like you're not, you cannot be distinguished by the clothing you wear or the class you're from or the proof. So anyhow, the egalitarianism that comes with some of these profound spiritual messages, it seemed to clash very much with these sort of rules that the intention, like whatever the intention may have been at the time, it just didn't feel like it was working with the present. And so I grappled with that so much. And the worst part of it was so hard to have this conversation with anybody.
Yeah, I bet.
I tried to talk to different imams about this, and I found it so hard to navigate that because, you know, I either got, well, like just an email with like quotes from of different passages saying like, we wouldn't condone this, or, you know, there's like, or just like not really paying, really sitting and trying to understand the perspective of a woman with like lived experience trying to navigate these things. Like, and so I like couldn't find that support through mosques or other religious leaders. And then of course I couldn't really express and talk about that within the family as well. And so it was quite it was something that I kept inside of me for quite a bit of time and that with. So not to go on, I just wanted to say that I think that this whole ordeal before what happened in Bangladesh and then even after I came back, it was really a process of me individuating from these cultural messages, of me like trying to understand some of the history behind how some of these, you know, rules were formulated and the social conditions of different time periods in Muslim history, and like really kind of trying to understand all of those things and kind of separate it out from, you know, my own lived experience. And I think to me, that was a very important thing to do, because I think what often happens is that like we can subscribe to authority quite easily. And especially I find like women sometimes might feel like they don't have a right to or ownership to engage in seeking, spiritually seeking answers or learning religious knowledge. And for me, it was the turning point was really just taking ownership of that and giving myself permission and saying, yeah, you know, I am going to these people to get answers, but I think it's okay. I think it's okay for me to also try to give some of those answers to myself and really thinking about my own, centering everything around also my own lived experiences. I think that that's important. And I feel like that's what's missing in a lot of the books I've read. I don't really, when it comes to learning about the religion, I don't hear much about Muslim women's experiences.
Right.
When I go into these mosques or other institutions, I don't see counselors who are. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the reason why now, you know, I'm like in the field of counseling and I have taken training on Islamic psychotherapy, because I think there's such a strong need for trying to understand the unique experiences of women of faith navigating their systems. But anyways, not to go on a tangent.
I
just, during that time, that's sort of how I navigated those pressures. And and not only that, I think you had said something earlier about faith and running through the heart. I can't quite remember.
Yeah, it's Alexander Solzhenitsyn who said that the line that separates good from evil, this is not, I'm paraphrasing the quote, but the line that separates that which is good from that which is evil runs through the heart of every man.
Yeah.
It's not out there. It's
exactly. Exactly. And so the Islamic, the search that I, my own personal seeking and searching, one, like a philosophy, and this is actually one of the core philosophies of the religion. You know, we talk about the heart being the center of existence. Functioning, actually, like with executive functioning, I mean, it's a very technical term, but like,
yes,
are like, you know, it's where everything gets integrated. So, yeah. You know, we have our thoughts, we have our emotions, we have our behavioral inclinations, like our nafs, like our habits that get formed, like our basic humanistic, like animalistic drives. We have like all these different components of the human psyche and experience, but everything gets filtered through the heart. It's sort of the center, and also the soul. And so I think for me, and I think different people will have different ways that they can connect to the faith. But for me, I always ask the question, why? And I always need to understand why. And so grounding my faith and like thinking about faith in this psychology of the human psyche has actually been very helpful to me, because it took me back to, okay, you know, there's these messages externally that I'm receiving. There's like these like laws and rules that I'm reading about. But at the end of the day, like I need to go back to my heart. There's these mosques that I'm visiting, like, there's these, you know, whatever it is that I'm doing, I coming back and trying to understand all the different parts of me that get activated at different times, and developing a self-awareness about what's internal self-awareness and introspection, I think has been one of the most helpful, you know, parts of my faith experience, and it has helped me gain a lot more ownership. Yeah. And then also just the emotions you mentioned, you know, in the quote, shame, yes. Fear. And, yeah. You know, like, I think that's the core of sometimes, like, when I have tried to have these conversations, or when I have, like, sat with thinking about those experiences, forbidden moments, it's really, like, the shame and the fear, and kind of allowing myself to sit with those emotions and try to understand them and understand like where they're coming from. Like perhaps a part of that is connected to, you know, the social conditioning and the social messages, but perhaps another part of that is connected to myself as a spiritual being and the lines and boundaries that I may feel that I am crossing by engaging in certain activities that like may not feel right to me, and like really kind of allowing myself to process some of those bigger, deeper emotions. And I think that's what's missing sometimes in our community, in faith communities, is like this we just acknowledgement of emotion and really just sitting with it and understanding it. And this is why it was so important for me. You mentioned earlier how I talk about like shaitan so easily in the book. It was important for me to, you know, talk about this gray space of not having answers, of sitting with feelings like shame and fear, and kind of, and it's through that experience, that haze and that darkness and that confusion that eventually an answer will emerge, but we need to allow ourselves to do that. What often happens is people get ostracized too early and too unnecessarily when they're just trying to process these emotions. And because, you know, it somehow brings up fear in another person in the faith community for whatever reason.
Surely, yeah. We're understandable.
So, yeah. We're almost out of time, but I do want to get to one last just quote from the book. And I really enjoyed this because it talks about how, you know, those that are on our path, and we've talked about this often on the podcast, those that are on our path are all there connecting with us in certain ways that we may not even be aware of. And you point to that in the book. And the quote is this that you write, Is it possible that all those who have touched us coexist in our hearts simply because their essence is really a manifestation of the attributes of God? Mm. It's what the person gave us, you know, their gift, something that we needed to see and experience at a particular point in time and becomes a part of us. When we own that part, we can let go. But with that means we love less. We can still appreciate their gifts from afar with a certain tenderness. Mm-hmm. The people I loved, the people for whom I am deeply grateful. And I thought maybe we could just wrap up the last few minutes we have today by just having you say more about the relationships you have now with family and friends, and how, you know, how is that a manifestation of the attributes of God?
Yeah. I would say writing this memoir has certainly been a journey, and you know, has triggered many different emotions for different people in my family, my circle.
Yeah, it's like, wow, this is very honest.
Yeah, so even that process in itself has been like I've had to process a lot, and I think part of what has helped me is understanding like people's limitations or capacities at various points and having compassion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were so many times along this journey where I felt like I was on this healing journey on my own. Mm. At some points I felt like others had joined me, but then I felt like I realized after that maybe not so much. Or wanted or desired so deeply. And so it was the similar feelings of, you know, pain have come up for me multiple times. And, you know, I think what has helped is each and every time, like it has actually brought me back to my faith, in that I've had to kind of go back and once again, just try to understand that people have different ways that they cope with mm-hmm. the experiences that they have. And certainly like in my family, like this was a very difficult challenge for me, but it did impact the rest of my family as well. And mm-hmm. so their own reactions to the experience. And so just kind of like holding space in a way where return to the what I mentioned at the very beginning of this podcast interview, this like feeling of ultimately God is the source of love. Mm-hmm. And in these really difficult moments and of pain, like what I really need to do is go back and allow myself to feel loved by God and love God. And ultimately, that is the most important thing. And so I think that has really grounded me a lot. And that doesn't mean that I cannot appreciate the gifts that all these other people in my life do offer, because they do offer different types of gifts. Mm-hmm. And so allowing myself to receive that and to reciprocate that, while at the same time know that like different people have different sort of thresholds of their own pain and their different ways of how much they can enter into my experience, if that makes sense. And so it's sort of been like a mantra or a reminder that has grounded me. I will say that, and I think just continuing to process some of the intergenerational traumas, trying to understand that a little bit more has certainly been helpful. When I work with clients, seeing clients experience the impacts of intergenerational trauma in different ways, well, mm-hmm. both from, you know, colonialism, but also from, you know, their own migration histories, and then just being here in Canada and their identities. And so I think like there's so much work left to be done. I think ultimately, you know, the centering it around personal, like you connect, like the personal, your personal connection to God at the end of the day is the most important thing. And even if you are God, and this is something I had to learn so many times where I felt very disappointed and angry, and just keeping that line of communication open with God, even if I feel like I'm certain days I hate God, like being able to conversation has been very helpful.
We echo that, and we're glad that, you know, we've had the opportunity to cross paths with you and your life story and your work, because in that way, as you say, we're maybe touching base here for reasons that we don't even imagine right now, but that will make manifest.
That's the beauty.
You know,
that's the beauty of it, isn't it, Rob?
That's the beauty of it. Yeah, that's the beauty of it. It's exactly. Yeah. So we're quite thankful that you've given us the time today and that you've put out your memoir and your book. And we want to thank you for being on the podcast and wish you all the best with it moving forward. Okay. Thanks so much.
Yeah, folks, I have to say to you, pick up The Shaitan Bride and you'll learn all about those five harrowing months that you had in Bangladesh as a 19-year-old, the pressures that were to bear, the generational traumas of colonialism and everything that's happened there. There's a lot to be said, and I learned a tremendous amount from it and from you. And I'm just proud that you're here, that you're Canadian, and that you're so honest with your faith story. So thank you for spending time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Thanks so much, Sumaya, again, and really appreciate the time and the work you've put into this. And this is a transformative memoir in many respects. So we encourage people to pick it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I noted at the beginning of this too, she really takes great pains to want to portray her faith and the faith of Islam as something very positive, which it really is. And this has been a great gift to us today too.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, guys. Good to get together again. Great to see you again, Ian. And we want to thank our sponsors just before we make our way out of here. One more time to A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. Our thanks to the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan come together to worship and to serve, and our good friends at Molly Maid. Make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. I'm Rob Henderson from Holy Trinity St. Stephen's.
Kevin George, St. Aidan's Church.
My name is Ian. Thank you for listening.
And remember, Kevin, to always look both ways. It's snowy out there and it's really dangerous.
You got to look both ways before you cross the street.
That's right. Slippery.
Slippery. Ooh, kablat.
Thank you for listening. Our hosts are Kevin George and Rob Henderson. Our producer and composer is myself, Ian, with original artwork done by Elizabeth Dodman. If you have any questions or want to know where to find us, tweet us at Vickers Crossing or find us on Facebook at The Vickers Crossing. If you have any other questions about anything heard on this podcast, leave us a comment or look in the description to find out more. Thanks!